Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Tuesday, April 29th, 2003, and we're here to continue our public hearing on House Bill 5014, which is the operations budget for the Department of Education, and House Bill 5015, which is the grant and aid budget for the Department of Education. I will open the public hearing on House Bill 5014 and House Bill 5015. And just by way of getting things going, the department has very kindly and very expeditiously provided us with the answers to some of the questions that we asked yesterday. And in the interest of being able to move along, because the department is, we're on a pretty tight time frame here, I would ask the members if they would read through this material today and bring questions forward at the beginning of tomorrow's session so that we can expedite this process. And with that, Mr. Costi, would you like to continue with your presentation?
Thank you, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Doug Costi, Director of Technology. We're starting on the sixth slide, kicking back into this. In response, perhaps, to Senator Gordley's closing comments on where we're at with student-level data collection, I thought it might be appropriate that I do mention that while there are strides to do the student-level data collections, and we're actually doing a lot of work in that area, a lot of work needs to be done still. The technology infrastructure is being built to support that level of detail, and I'll get into more details on that component as we go forward. My staff functions are basically in three categories: network, support, help desk, and outreach. Database development and maintenance, and applications development and maintenance. The network and help desk staff are there essentially to connect the desktops and support the users on a day-to-day basis within the organization. When I say support, I mean they answer questions on email, applications, those kind of things, make sure that everybody's got the right version and they have access to the right level of tool sets. The other component of that team is the outreach team. The outreach team is that group of folks that actually coordinate the calls or the help desk for the schools and districts throughout the state. As we mentioned before, we do a lot of web-based data collection and reporting. So that information that is being taken from the school and district systems is submitted to the department. There are typically lots of questions on how to do that, what the rules are, timing, and that kind of thing. This help desk or this outreach team is the first point of contact for those staff out in the field, the teachers, the administrators, et cetera. So they touch a very broad base of personnel throughout the state. The database team, just to kind of give you a sense of what this group does, they build those containers of information about schools and districts, about the processes that are applied in those schools, such as length of school days, class sizes. They also build staff information databases and student information databases. Those databases are interrelated, and this team is their sole purpose is to build these containers and make those containers talk to one another, so that information then can be related. As I talked earlier, you know, the focus of this team is to break down those silos or those individual containers of information. The application development staff, that group builds the applications or the screens that allow districts to submit information into and before it gets into the database container and receive feedback in terms of whether the data was good or if there were problems with it, what kind of problems they encountered, and recommendations to fix the data so that in the end, we have good quality information being put into these containers so that when we go out and provide reports and analysis, the information is valid and collected in a timely manner. There are two basic websites that my application team developed. The public site, which is you can see the URL there. It's www.ode.state.or.us. This is where the public goes to get information about the department and the various programs contained therein. A subset of that public site is the Database Initiative site, which contains all of those reports that your taxpayers, your teachers, your administrators, you get from the Quality Ed Commission. Those type of reports are posted on that portion of the public website. I've included the URL to go directly to the DBI site there. In the handout site I provided for you in your book, there's some colored pages that represent school and district profiles from each of your specific districts and schools. And I've color coordinated them so that at some point if you want to look at them and compare how your schools are doing against one another, you can do that. Those profiles are available in a date comparison fashion, so you could take a school or a district and look at the progress from one year to the next, or you can look at a school or a district in comparison to another school or district. So they're really useful. If you haven't been to the DBI site, I would really encourage it. There's a lot of great information there. The other site that we support is the district site. This is the site where districts go to submit information, get specific information about data, when we need to collect it, timelines, rules for collection, those kind of things. This is our interface to the districts and schools throughout the state. The department is not like a lot of agencies within the state in terms of the staff or the stakeholders that we deal with. We have a real tight connection with the districts and the schools and communicate with them on a daily basis. To give you an example, there are probably approximately 50 different data collections from 1,250 schools and 198 districts and 21 ESDs. So there's a lot of information being collected from these various entities.
Do you have a performance measure that helps you gauge the feedback from the people that at the districts and at the school level and at the ESD level about how your data collection and your help desk and your training efforts work for them?
In terms of the benchmark, I guess the best benchmark is what ends up on the report in a timely manner. And if we don't get the information out, for example, on those school profile forms, it's announced to the public. If you look at some of the reports on there, there are data missing, and it will show up as NA. So that's our immediate clue that the information isn't being provided. And we hear about it from not just taxpayers, but district personnel as well. They want to know where it is in the process. It's a very public, open process that anyone can take a look at. So it's nothing that's being held back from them. On the second note, I mentioned that we meet monthly with the IT managers. A good part of those meetings revolve around data collection and reporting requirements that we put forth to them. And they let us know if we're asking the wrong questions, if the information cannot be collected, or if it's the wrong type of questions. The new performance measures that we just laid out with the Oregon Progress Board include measures on customer service as well.
And how do you measure the customer service then?
The customer service would include things like are we providing the right level of training to the school districts and the schools when we ask them for information?
And how do you know if the answer is yes or no?
We haven't designed the survey form, but I would assume there would be some type of an optional survey developed that districts could submit to us.
Thank you.
Basically, there's two types of data collection methodologies. One is to have an IT center extract the data from their system into a predefined file layout or format. So it's basically an electronic version of a data set. They do that. We call that an SMF or a standard message format. And many of the districts that have large IT centers or are supported by large IT centers prefer that method because they can go to their system, push a button, and it takes the appropriate information out of their system and creates a file, an electronic file. They go to that district website, put the file into that website, into the appropriate collection, and it provides them immediate feedback in terms of whether the data was good, whether it was timely, if there were errors with it, what to do to fix it. So that information is immediately fed back to the district. The second method is a web survey form. For those districts that don't have electronic systems or those types of surveys that may not be contained in an information system or in a computer database at the district level, they're allowed to just type the information into a web survey form, much like a paper form, but it's just on the screen. And they submit that information, same process. They get feedback on that information in terms of how valid it was, if there were issues with it, et cetera. I've listed here a few of the people from your areas that are very familiar with this if you get an opportunity to talk to them. Jerry Anderson of Medford, Nancy Grishong of Roseburg, Scott Robinson of Portland Public, Keith Isley of Multnomah ESD, and Tim Enright of Coos Bay. So if you get a chance to talk to any of those folks, they can give you more information on what it's like to submit data into the department. The next slide is a two-part slide. The first part is basically a schematic showing what we do currently, what the database initiative built. Essentially, districts and ESDs submit school and district level data, either financial or non-financial, into the database initiative through one of those two means, the web survey or the SMF format. Building on the infrastructure that we used to build the database initiative, we created the secure student ID. This was created in response to the need to collect consistent information about students. As Senator Gordley represented yesterday, it's very difficult to follow kids' progress over time in one district, let alone from a statewide perspective. But it's important to identify where the kids have gone to school, what programs they've been involved in order to do real good program evaluation and progress. So we developed what's called the SSID. That's the state secure identifier, so that each child in the state is given a number, a state assigned number, on a one-time basis. And periodically, the districts submit this information to the state so that we can follow those children through the system. That's important so that we can really follow the progress, and we can tie the assessments to the appropriate kids, and that we can tie the program information about those kids as they go through the system. So I'm gonna drill into that student data box in the next slide, but to continue this conversation, essentially the information that's contained in the secure student ID will allow us to uniquely identify a child. However, the information that is used to uniquely identify that child is kept in the SSID, and only that information that is necessary to follow the child as they move through the system and to correlate the different programs that they've been involved with all through to the student data component. The student level data then moves to this box called extract, transform, and load. And what that means is we take that information and combine it and aggregate it to the appropriate level so that we can either put it into DBI at the school level or district level, or we can move it into the student database at the student level. Once we get it into the student database, then we have the opportunity to align or to interrelate the students and various programs, as well as the assessments, to follow how groups of kids are doing. If we go to the next slide, we're going to drill into to give you an idea of where we're at.
Question.
Sure.
Is it possible, using the information that you're tracking on the student, to track the students by the teachers that they get?
Currently, no. Chair Morgan, currently there is not the possibility to tie the student to the teacher at any degree of confidence. The primary reason for that is the student information systems that are contained at the district level are separate from the staffing systems. And even at a district level, it would be difficult to tie, while not impossible, to tie the students and the teachers. At the state level, we haven't gone to that level yet, and it's not even on our radar screen in terms of how we would tie the student results to the teacher at this point in time. It's pretty complex to get to that level.
So at this point, they're using the database then. There is no way to track teacher performance relative to student performance?
Not that I'm aware of, Chair Morgan. No, I think if we stepped back from it and looked at high level, maybe school and grade, you would have a sense of groupings of teachers. We wouldn't, because we wouldn't have that tie in our system. It hasn't been designed to that level at this point in time. Certainly it could be done, and at some point may be done, but it's not in the foreseeable future in this design or this architecture.
Thank you.
This next slide shows you where we're at today relative to hooking this state-assigned ID into these various collections. The boxes in white are on the drawing table. They're on our radar screen to be done, but contingent upon funding, they're just in limbo right now. The assessments are the ones that are tied in initially. All of the assessment scores have been given an SSID. I believe this is the first year we have the entire population with a secure student ID assigned to the assessments. Migrant Ed, OPTE are on the drawing board. Special education, I believe there's plans in place to embed the secure ID into that data collection coming up in this December. If you follow the information as it flows into that student level database, this is the first year of the database at the student level. There's a lot of work that is yet to be done on that database. As you can imagine, the more information, the more programs you add to it, the more tweaking we have to do to that database. So this slide just gives you an indication of where we're at with it in terms of building out that student level database.
Sure.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in migrant education. Are we talking about migrant workers and their families' education, or are we just talking about students that transfer from one school to another, from one state to another? And if I'm very interested in, especially in that aspect of how do you track from school to school or state to state, or we know that more and more our families are moving around throughout their careers and their lifetimes. So.
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, I can't get into a lot of detail about the migrant education program. I'll tell you what I do know about it. But the migrant education program is for those children of migrant workers that move on a periodic basis, and there's a frequency, and I don't know it off the top of my head. That's a program that's run out of the Student Services Division. But that information is currently in an application and is monitored on a student level basis.
Could I have a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Then, are the databases compatible so that you can track without interruption students that move from one state to another or even within the state and keep track of their performance and their needs?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, I can't answer that because that system is being run out of the Willamette Education Service District, so I don't have a lot of familiarity with the system. I know that when I was in the private sector, okay, we'll get the answer.
Thank you.
Moving right along. The database initiative has really helped us out in a lot of different areas. It provides useful information, as I've indicated in the forms that are in your handout, on school and districts. It provides us the foundation for the school fund formula. It also supplies information to the U.S. Department of Education, as well as for federal programs. It provides a lot of information for legislative requests, as well as the Quality Education Commission and the Oregon report card, the state report card, and the school report cards. In addition to the web-based applications that serve our constituents or our stakeholders, we also build or augment applications that have been designed by the Department of Administrative Services. While DAS provides some great foundational systems specific to a real general broad base of customer, we have specific needs. So what this slide shows you is some of the work that we've done on some of these smaller applications internal to build upon what DAS has provided. And the reason I bring it here is just to let you know that they've been built and they are transferable to other agencies. Next slide talks about the information technology staffing analysis. At the close of the 2001 session, there was a budget note drafted that requested DAS, IRMD, and human resources division to take a look at the Department of Education technology department or division, and the appropriateness of the staffing levels, the vision, and the use of contractors. I've included a copy of that staffing analysis in your binders, and the report's in there. And it talks about our vision. It pointed out some of our shortfalls in terms of communicating adequately with our stakeholders, our vision. It also pointed out that while our vision was appropriate, the staffing levels that we had laid out were probably inadequate, and that we needed to focus in additional areas, such as more help desk, more training, more quality assurance. We needed work on standards and implementation. So I bring this to your attention because I think it's important that you know this, and I understand that we are in a very difficult budget timeline, but I wanted to at some point be able to come back and request those staff or the appropriate staffing levels should the financial picture shift or change or improve, hopefully. Out of that study on slide 13, there were a couple of things that we've identified that we need to work on a little better and more quickly in order to do a good job and be fiscal stewards of our resources. Project prioritization is at the top of my list in terms of things we can do to look at the work we're doing internally. We need to have a way to look at the projects to come to my table and have a way to say, yeah, this needs to get done, or no, this doesn't, and put it in a pecking order. So what we've done since I got here was to align projects with priorities, to identify prioritization criteria, criteria such as is it a mandate of the federal or state requirement? Is it directly aligned with our mission, goals, and objectives? Does it result in efficiencies and savings? And are there funds available outside of the general fund to perform this work? So these are the filters that I put my projects through before I put them on the table and go forward with them. In addition, we face security issues on a daily basis. As many of you know, there's a lot of email spam and virus attacks on computer systems, so we have to deal with those on a regular basis. And my teams are involved in building standards in conjunction with the recommendations from DAS. We have implemented project management methodology standards that really assist us in identifying who the stakeholders are, who the sponsors are, and coming to agreement on what the objectives, measures of success, and real requirements of the projects are. The next slide builds on the technology plan. The technology plan for education was referenced as part of the DAS study and is also included in your list of supplemental materials. And I'm going to just go briefly through this so that you can kind of get a picture of where we would like to go. But what I want to underscore here is this vision is on hold. While we know we need to go here, we're doing all we can just to keep in sync with what we have to do, what's on the table today. But we think it's important, I think it's important that we have a vision going forward. So if you look at this diagram from left to right, the sources of information are information that's coming from districts, from pre-K programs, from ESDs, from other state agencies that impact the educational world or databases. These sources of information go through a series of applications, either at the district level, the state level, or ODE's level. Eventually, they get put in. The information gets put into these databases that my team are building and creating. And at the end, what we have are outputs or portals of information about the educational environment. And I like to think of this vision as a pre-K through 20 vision for education. We really need to look at blurring the lines between the pre-K, the K-12, and the higher ed communities in order to have a real good, successful vision. Some of the outputs are e-learning. We need to provide opportunities for not just staff, or not just students in terms of distance learning, getting access to quality courses, but staff as well. Analysis capabilities outside of our agency. We need more accountability tools, and we need to hone and refine our reporting outputs. One of the things that I wanted to point out on this slide also is that there are a number of redundant systems across the K-12 environment. And when I say K-12, I'm talking districts and the IT centers. There's another handout in your binder. It's called the Data Integrity Assurance Project. That project was the kickoff of a budget package that was eventually eliminated through the department. And what it recognized was that there were over 25 student information systems in a number of IT centers or data centers throughout the state, and that there are efficiencies to be realized by consolidating or shrinking the number of student information systems and financial systems in existence across the K-12 environment. recognizing that something needed to be done, a group of the IT community that meet monthly have created a task force to go forward and at least do a feasibility study to say, does it make sense to consolidate these student information systems, and we're focused on student information at this point in time, into a single system. So there are a group of us working on that. A number of IT managers across the state are involved in that. And just wanted you to be aware that, you know, we do not take this lightly. In order to achieve this vision, we need to have tighter control of the information. Slide 15, projects on the horizon, data collection, consolidation. This is just a list of projects that are on my radar screen that we know need to get done, but they're unfunded. They're not something that we have the resources to do right now, but we know there are things that need to be done, and you need to be aware of them. Data collection, consolidation. As we move from student or from school and district level collections, there's a lot of efficiencies that can be gained by going to student level data collections and taking the student level and aggregating it up. We can do a lot more with that granular level of information. The statewide student information system consolidation I talked about. The student plans and profiles. There are a set of requirements that outline what are the essential elements of a student plan and a student profile. The specifications have been built. It's provided a lot of good groundwork, but it's just that, it's specifications. There's no funding beyond that to actually build these systems.
Representative Smith.
Talking about your student plan and profiles, on your profiles, what type of information is going to be collected about students?
Representative Morgan, Chair Morgan, Representative Smith. It's information on where the child is today in their educational career in terms of what courses they've taken, what degrees they've received, what areas of interest they've shown, what things outside the classroom they've taken. Those are the kind of things that are in the profile.
Do you have personal information?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, yes, there is personal
like
information.
Like what?
Name, address, whatever. The profile is for the student.
Do you have information as to race or whether their parents are divorced or what religion they are or school activities?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, the information is more like the activities that they were involved in, not personal information such as the religious background.
What's to keep you from obtaining personal information in their profiles? See, I'm a little concerned when you talk student profiles. I assume that you want this to be done from pre-K through college. I'm concerned about a security issue. I'm concerned how that information is going to be used. I think right now, since this hasn't been developed, that you're saying, oh, it's good for our data collection and knowledge base and all this kind of stuff. But I can see this leading to areas we don't want to go.
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, the information that is contained on the profile or would be contained on the profile is not information that the state would be concerned about collecting. In fact, the profile right now is a concept. It's just a document that says, here's what would be on it. So we don't currently collect it. We have no intent as a department to collect that information.
I know you don't have intent to collect it. What is to keep you from collecting it? Oh, you know, I can see somebody on the database. Let's just add they were involved in this activity or the student was suspended for a protest, or this student is of this religion. We'll just put that on there just because, oh, I have room in my database. What is to keep somebody unintentionally from adding this information?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, I could give you a copy of the specifications, and you could take a look at them.
I would like to do that.
Okay.
And then how is this information going to be used?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, this information is to be used by the child. It is not to be used by schools or districts. It's a tool for the child and their parents to develop their education plan.
Does the department have access to the information?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, currently it's just a specification. There is no plan for the department to have access to that information.
Well, then I wonder about why we need it if supposedly the department doesn't access the information, district doesn't access the information, but the student can access the information. Doesn't the student already know what they're doing?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, I think you're getting a little beyond my ability to answer these questions.
Well, I raise these questions. Mike Greenfield, and there's other people here listening. I have a real problem, you know, going with this. And you say you have this in your plan. You say you have information you can give me, but you can't answer basic questions. I am real concerned about how far we go with this. I think it could lead to profiling. I'm not certain that this information is going to be used in the absolute purest, innocent form that you're saying. I'm just not there yet. I guess you need to convince me otherwise.
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, can we follow up with the
Yeah, that would be great. Come to my office.
Okay.
And there appears to be a first row conference going on the subject.
Good.
Please proceed.
Okay, moving right along. The last slide for technology is a slide on the Oregon Public Education Network. As I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, the Oregon Public Education Network, or OPEN, is a grant-based component of my budget. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background on OPEN for perspective. OPEN, again, was created at the request of Superintendent Norma Paulus to go forth and create a network, a statewide network, to connect schools and districts. Having done that and providing that great infrastructure, They built some other real great programs, and I'm going to list a couple of them here. The STRUT, which is the Students Using Recycled Technologies, is a program that was started by OPEN, and that creates opportunities for technology instruction in the classroom, as well as recycling computers that are being passed down from the private sector, et cetera, and moving them into the classroom so that they can get access to these great technology resources at low cost, and providing instruction for class or students on technologies. The Clearinghouse is a suite of education learning or distance learning opportunities that connects or facilitates the connection or access to various learning opportunities. So these are a couple examples of the type of program that OPEN has brought forward. OPEN has three major focuses. First is to provide a unified voice for the K-12 school and district community. It's important that we maintain those partnerships. Outside of the agency or within the agency, we need some kind of connection to the group that draws everybody together and provides this unified voice for the K-12 grouping. OPEN, if we step to the next bullet, network coordination, OPEN provides a means of equitable access for all districts. What that means is rural Oregon schools, rural southern eastern Oregon schools, have the same access to network infrastructure and internet service providers as urban schools do at this point. Distance learning, again, they provide that. The goal here is to provide coordination for voice and video. I think most of you have seen the Oregon Access Network and the VTEL, video teleconferencing. There are video centers set up throughout the ESDs as well as most of the high schools. I think there's just a few high schools that do not have access to the VTEL conferences at this point in time. So this concludes my presentation on technology. If you have any questions.
Madam Chair. Senator Ford.
Thank you, and good morning. Given what you just said about the priority, or one of the priorities, I think you said first priority is to maintain a unified voice for K-12. And then you talked about equitable access. Is equitable access also a priority within the work that you've just talked about? I'm just trying to figure out the place of that as a priority.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, when I talk about equitable access from a network perspective, it means that they can have similar access to the same quality of network service provider that the urban areas such as the metro area would have. Certainly they're not going to get the same for the same dollar, but it needs to be, the vision or the goal is to have something comparable. If we don't have this leveling of access, then folks in rural Oregon will pay a higher price and get slower bandwidth or slower access to the network.
I guess, Madam Chair, I would state just a comment that one of my concerns is that we not jeopardize educational opportunities that are offered through distance learning to rural areas of the state, and I've yet to gain a sense of where that fits as a priority for the department, and look forward to hearing more later. The point being that our rural communities have long been underserved in a number of areas, educationally speaking, and we've laid the groundwork over the last, looking back over the last couple of sessions, to put in place some things that have made a difference. The Frontier Learning Network comes to mind, and so my concern is that we may be taking actions through the budget or making choices through the budget that would dismantle or erode the progress that's been made, and that progress really addresses the issue of equitable access for these rural communities. That's a comment. If you'd like to address the comment, that would be fine.
Well, perhaps, Senator, a question that needs to be asked here then is, how does the Frontier Learning Network get, how does it work with relation to OPEN?
Chair Morgan, I don't know the answer to that question.
Would the department please get us an analysis of that and distribute it to the members of the committee?
We can do that.
Senator Gordley, did you have any follow-up comments?
I would look forward to getting that analysis and then any other information that can be provided to us orally in follow-up presentations would be very helpful. Again, Madam Chair, I just want to underscore the issue is equitable access, and particularly in our rural areas.
I think that we're all aware, especially those of us that represent rural areas, of the issues that we face in terms of being able to provide for the students in the schools any kind of special classes, high-level classes, or classes that are a little bit off the beaten track. And certainly using OPEN, I know in my district, is one of the ways that we use to spread that teaching expertise out over a large geographic area and give students an opportunity to access those kinds of classes. So this is really important. I would be very interested in a detailed analysis of how the Frontier Learning Network factors into this. Senator Mazzarin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that part of the open program is to provide access to all schools in the state. And I know they've made tremendous progress. Does every school in the state have access to open or to the internet distance learning?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, as in it seems to me that 98% are served by a high-speed connection of some sort. But there are a few schools in very rural Oregon that are still relying upon telephone modem access. Financially, it's not feasible to put the high-speed bandwidth out there.
And so if that access is complete, is the focus now to the content or the offerings of the program?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, that is correct.
And
maintaining the existing infrastructure.
Could you get us some information as to what kinds of programs are being offered?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, we can do that.
Thank you.
So is it safe to assume that if a district doesn't have a broadband, a DSL line, that they can't do the video, the VTEL part of this, that they're stuck with whatever's online?
There are, Chair Morgan, the VTEL offerings are different from what's on the internet or through the network. It's a different type of coursework. It's more interactive video conferencing where you get up in front of a TV and you communicate with someone on another part of the state. As opposed to the internet at this point in time, while there are streaming video courses and content out there, the majority of that type of thing is web-based, download lesson plans and work on your own pace type of thing.
Thank you. Further questions or comments before we close this section? Thank you very much. This has been very informative. We're going to get off of the schedule a little bit here, and I will call forward Associate Superintendent Neuer to do a presentation on the Office of Professional Technical Education, because I understand that you have some conflicting or some scheduling constraints.
That's the dark green tab. And dark green tab.
That is, yes, go about two-thirds of the way there. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Salam Noor. I'm the Associate Superintendent in the Office of Professional Technical Education. Thank you very much for your willingness to accommodate my schedule. I certainly appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity to share information with you today about the Office of Professional Technical Education, including its functions, its programs and activities, budget, and performance.
Mr. Noor, could you kindly pull the microphone around?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Better? Great. Professional technical education, as you may well be aware, includes career and technical education programs, activities, and experiences in high schools and community colleges. In Oregon, there are six career areas organized that schools and community colleges use to organize their programs and offer those programs to their students. Those include natural resources, human resources, health services, industrial and engineering systems, arts and communications, and business and management. You will notice in my presentation that I frequently refer to community college programs when I speak about secondary programs as well. That's because the Office of Professional Technical Education is responsible for providing support and leadership to professional technical education in Oregon on behalf of the Department of Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. The Carl Perkins funds that we receive from the federal government are divided equally between the Department of Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And I would add that this is a good example of coordination and partnership between the two agencies that have managed to eliminate a lot of barriers and coordinate their services and deliver them in a very efficient manner to both secondary schools and community colleges. The Office of Professional Technical Education relies primarily on federal funds to support its programs and activities. Our department operations are supported primarily by federal funds up to 76%. 16% of our funds are general fund and 8% are other funds. Our grant and aid is also primarily federal funds, and 97% of those funds flow directly to the field. And 3% is general fund, and that goes directly to support the Student Leadership Development Center and its activities. Our staff consists of 29.1 FTE, and our staff work with elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, and community colleges to support program development and improvement and implementation at both the secondary and community college level. The Office of Professional Technical Education is responsible for the development of the state plan for professional technical education in consultation with key stakeholders such as teachers, students, administrators at both the secondary and community college level, and we often engage our business and community partners as well. The plan is submitted to the U.S. Department of Education on behalf of the State Board of Education, who also serves as the State Board for Vocational and Technical Education in the state of Oregon. OPTE, the Office of Professional Technical Education, is responsible for overseeing and managing the plan, developing statewide policies and procedures, developing program standards, program and student performance measures, program review and evaluation standards, and also provide support and leadership and technical assistance to school and to schools and community colleges around professional technical education throughout the state. We have several programs that are supported by staff in the Office of Professional Technical Education. One of our primary functions is professional technical education because of the level of funding that we receive from the federal government in the Carl Perkins Act for Vocational and Technical Education. Our efforts are divided into four areas, and those include secondary programs, community college programs, post-high school connections or dual credit programs, and student leadership activities. Our secondary programs provide students opportunities for career exploration and preparation. Professional technical education programs help students gain technical knowledge and skills, academic knowledge and skills, and career-related learning skills such as teamwork, communication, and career development. Community college programs tend to be a bit more occupationally specific, and they provide students opportunities to gain occupational skills and opportunities or an opportunity to upgrade existing skills that will make them more competitive in the workplace. Community college programs often lead to an Associate of Applied Science degree, a certificate of completion, as well as industry credentials and certifications. The post-high school connections or dual credit program, and we often refer to it as Tech Prep as part of the Carl Perkins Act, is a key component of our professional technical efforts in the state of Oregon, and it provides opportunities for students to earn college credit while in high school and get a jump start on their college education at a very affordable price. We have an exemplary program here in the state of Oregon, and we are pleased with the opportunities that students have while they're in high school. A good example to share with you is from the dual credit program between Lincoln County Schools and the Oregon Coast Community College. This year, 75 students from Newport, Taft, Toledo, and Waldport High Schools earned 358 college credits from the Oregon Coast Community College at a cost of $1,125. If you were to compare that to the pre-credit cost of $15,394, you will find that students, parents, and Oregon taxpayers have saved approximately $14,000 as a result of those students participating in the dual credit program. We also have research both in the state and nationally that demonstrates that students that participate in these types of programs are more likely to be successful in their post-secondary education. Another key component of PTE programs is student leadership, and students learn academic and technical knowledge and skills, leadership, citizenship, character enhancement, and personal and career development through seven student leadership organizations that provide services to students statewide. And the leadership organizations you might be familiar with include FFA, FBLA, Skills USA, and many others, and they're distributed statewide through activities, awards, and recognition programs that vary by the individual student leadership organization. Our high school improvement effort...
Now, if I might interject here for a minute, we have a group of students that joined us a few minutes ago, and these are students, again, from Westland Middle School in Corvallis, and we welcome you here today to be at a hearing. We're working right now on the budgets for the Department of Education that oversees the K-12 system that you're real interested in right now, and also the community college system and the higher ed system. So stay tuned. This is going to affect your next couple of school years. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. The other program that we have in the Office of Professional Technical Education, and it really isn't a program, it's just an effort that we have related to high school improvement. And our focus is working with high schools and helping high schools build capacity to develop programs that personalize student learning and programs that meet the individual needs and interests of every student in the high school. The education plan and profile that was discussed earlier is a tool that will assist schools in personalizing students' high school experiences. Our systems integration effort focuses primarily on the alignment of secondary community college.
Smith has a question.
I raised the issue on the last one, and you here have again, education plan and profile. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do with your profile?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith. The education plan is primarily a planning tool for students and their parents to meet the individual interests and needs of that students. And it's also a vehicle that allows schools to determine what students are interested in and perhaps organize their curriculum and programs and course offerings in the following year to meet student interests. The profile, to my knowledge, is basically a document that captures students' successes, achievements, accomplishments during their high school years, and the students have the opportunity to use that to present to employers as they pursue employment opportunities or present it to admission officers in community colleges and universities to demonstrate what activities they've been involved in.
So, you say you do their successes. Do you document their failures as well? And what would keep you from documenting that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, the intent is really to focus on the highlights of the student's career while they're in high school and give them the opportunity to note their successes and be able to reflect on their failures as well. We have no intention of documenting their failures.
I'm just going to say again, as I said to the gentleman who preceded you, I think you need to be very careful along these lines. I'm not convinced that a student profile is where we need to be spending our money or our emphasis. I understand you think that you might have protections built into the system, but I'm concerned years down the line, you know, how this student information is going to be used. As far as profiling, it's very, very explosive. It could be. Most students know what they do. Most students, I think, are very aware of the successes they have had. I understand a plan is very good. You know, I'm not objecting to that at all. It's good that students think about what they're doing and where they're heading and things like that. But this profiling business, I just can't see that the Department of Education wants to go there too far.
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, I appreciate your concerns.
And then my follow-up thing, too. What safeguards do you have in place to keep it from going too far? What preventive measures? Because mm-hmm. I don't see that, I don't know what those are.
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, I appreciate your concerns, and we will provide you with information that hopefully will shed more light on the effort around the profile. And your cautions are valid ones, and we will definitely take those into consideration as we pursue that work.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The other programs that the office is responsible for include service learning, trips to teachers, and distance education. Service learning is learning that leads to community development, civic engagement, character development, leadership, and student success. and it is learning that occurs through service and meeting a specific community need. Service learning is student-based, student-driven. There is a reflection piece that's associated with that and allows the students to engage their community around some key critical issues, very meaningful experiences. The Troops to Teachers program is a new program to Oregon. We've only had it for a few months, and it's designed to assist military personnel in making successful transitions to second careers as public school teachers. Distance learning includes a variety of technologies used to deliver educational and professional development resources to Oregon students, teachers, and especially in rural areas.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Mr. Noor, could you give an example of what you mean by character development, or give an example of what's going on out there around the state that would help us understand your example?
Mm-hmm. Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, I believe you're referring specifically to the area of service learning.
Yes.
And a key component of service learning is civic engagement, is allowing the students to engage in issues that are very pertinent to their community and develop leadership skills around those issues and learn skills such as responsibility, commitment, obligations, and awareness of the nature and culture of their community, and be able to play a very effective and engaged role in the issues that will improve community conditions in relationship to education, but also in a broader social context as well.
That's helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I mentioned earlier that the
Can
Office of Professional Technical...
One second, Mr. Noor. In distance education, can you talk to us about what aspects of distance education that you deal with that are different than the previous presentation that we had? Mm-hmm. We're talking probably content as opposed to hardware.
Right. Chair Morgan, in the previous presentation, you heard about the infrastructure issues related to distance education. Our part is to really bring awareness to local education entities, both secondary schools and community colleges, about the use of different technologies and the modalities that are available to them to deliver instructions and to provide access to a great extent to students around the state. We have all sorts of programs that vary. Actually, we have some secondary programs, middle school programs, and elementary programs that engage students in activities that use distance learning to engage them in those experiences. I'm trying to remember one of the programs that we have is the Lewis and Clark Expedition, for example, that allows students in rural areas to engage in activities that are happening in the Portland area or even in Washington State, for that matter. I don't have a lot of details about that project because I'm not working with it directly. But at the community college level, we work with community colleges and high schools to facilitate connections through technology that allows students to access community college programs and courses, and also allows students in high schools to access courses that may be available to them in neighboring area high schools or others across the state. So some of the activities also focus on delivering staff development through distance learning.
Thank you.
Our Carl Perkins funds The majority of Carl Perkins funds, up to 85%, are grant and aid that flow directly to community colleges and high schools, and those are split equally between colleges and high schools in the state. The project dollars, I would like to point out, are used specifically to support innovative programs and special projects around the state. And we've talked briefly about distance learning. We've talked about dual credit programs, and just recently we use some of those resources, for example, to support four projects in the state that are very much linked to economic development, including the area of healthcare, information technology, paraprofessional teacher preparation as required by the No Child Left Behind Act, and pre-engineering programs. And the intent is to use those resources to develop distance learning opportunities between high schools and community colleges to facilitate that access, and also identify prerequisites that students can complete in high school before they advance to colleges and universities. So we try to use those for targeted investments. 5% of those funds are also designed for state administration, which includes grants management, accountability, performance measures, and reporting. There is a 5% maintenance of effort match or requirement for these grants, but this is a very effective investment of resources. For every $1 that we spend in general fund, we leverage approximately $30 in federal funds. The other portion of Carl Perkins funds are tech prep resources that we use for dual credit programs, and those funds support 18 high school and community college consortiums that support dual credit activities around the state, and 95% of those funds flow to those consortiums. The next slide shows the service learning funds that we receive from the federal government as well. And 75% of those funds are grant and aid resources. They are provided to schools and districts on a competitive basis. The capacity building portion of those funds includes staff development activities, resource development and best practices, research and dissemination essential for program development and implementation, and only 5% of those funds are used directly for state administration. The other areas that we have some resources in are the Student Leadership Development Center, and we have grant and aid dollars that flow directly to support student leadership activities and the 7 student leadership organizations around the state. Our distance education funds support staff development activities, as I mentioned earlier, training schools and educational partners around the use of technology. We also try and develop policy development and guidelines for statewide access and use, including protocols and procedures. And some of the funds also are also used to support the Salem Teleconferencing Center and the Public Service Building. Our Troops to Teachers funds are designed specifically for coordination and dissemination of information activities between schools and the various branches of the military government. Okay. Now that I have shared with you how we use our funds, I would like to share with you some of the results and activities, some of the results of these activities. We often ask ourselves about the return on these investments, both in the general fund dollars and the federal fund dollars, and how we will actually measure the impact on student achievement. As you can see from the slides, through these programs, projects, and activities, we have been able to increase student opportunities and positively impact student achievement. This is evident by the number of students that participate in PTE programs in over 227 high schools across the state. We also have some preliminary data which indicates that students who take 2 or more PTE credits in high school, referred to here as concentrators, have exceeded state averages for statewide assessments in math and reading and writing. The following 2 slides will illustrate that data from that we have collected over a 3-year period. This data demonstrates how PTE students have performed in the area of math problem solving, and I would like to direct your attention to the distinct improvement over a 3-year period. We are really pleased with these results and delighted to share them at every opportunity we have. If I may direct your attention to the next slide, the same applies to math multiple choice tests.
Going out to sign up.
We hope so. You will notice similar results in the area of math multiple choice. What this data tells us is that, and we do recognize that this is preliminary data and it will need further research and verification, but demonstrates that students learn better in context, and especially when they recognize the relevance of their education and school experiences to future goals and aspirations. This data also, in our opinion, contributes to student retention and completion of programs and high school, which will contribute to the reduction of the dropout rate as well. Another measure of success includes the number of students that participate in dual credit programs and the number of college credits they earn as a result of that. In the state, there are 210 high schools that have articulation and dual credit agreements with all 17 community colleges. And this is something that speaks very highly of our dual credit programs and the partnerships that exist between community colleges and high schools throughout the state. In addition to dual enrollment, we also look at the success rate in post-secondary education and training for our students. Our follow-up data indicates that PTE students are successful in their next steps and pursuits, including retention in community college programs and completion of those two programs, especially 2 years after high school. And these programs, if I may add, play a critical role in economic development and workforce preparation, especially at the community college level. We have over 22,000 students in community college programs across the state, and these programs help train Oregon's current and emerging workforce and provide them with the skills employers want and need. Other measures that we look at is the number of students that participate in student leadership organizations, service learning activities, and the opportunities students have to pursue personal, academic, and career goals that lead to positive experiences both in high school and facilitate a smooth transition to post-secondary education and training. We measure that by the access students have to comprehensive guidance and counseling programs, the education plans that they are developing that will help inform their future direction in terms of areas that they're interested in and courses they would like to take to support that interest, and also the work-based learning or non-school-based learning opportunities that are available for students. One of the key benefits of the use of technology to students, and especially students in rural area, is access to statewide programs that may not be available locally. Access to resources by students, teachers, administrators, in rural areas increases student options and opportunities, and distance learning has actually facilitated that access and has increased the participation of students in our programs.
Well, we are just taking a break here. I might welcome another group of students from Westland Middle School in Corvallis. And just to give you some contextual information here, we're doing the budget for the Department of Education, which oversees the functioning in the K-12 school system. So this is going to be your life for the next couple of years. So pay some attention here. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. In closing, I'm delighted to share with you that despite the challenges and the tough fiscal times high schools and colleges are facing today, and the fact that many programs are risking elimination, there are over 1,100 secondary programs in 227 high schools across the state, and there are over 1,500 community college programs in 17 colleges across the state as well. It is imperative to support and maintain these programs for their role in developing and preparing a high-quality workforce. These programs meet high academic and technical skills standards. They meet the State Board of Education standards. They are connected to economic development and labor market trends and needs, both locally and statewide, and often to national trends as well. They provide critical training to Oregon's current and emerging workforce and provide quality experiences for students at both the secondary and community college level. This concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Senator Masri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. When I was going through my education, it's called vocational education.
Yes.
I think we've upgraded the name of it, really. But I'm just very supportive of this type of education, and it really ties it together for the students. And
sure.
And as I've talked in previous days about motivation and focusing for students, I think these programs do a great job of that. So I'm very supportive.
I very much agree with you, Senator Masley, and what has come to my mind as you've taken us through these programs are the discussion that we had previously in this committee about the grants that have been made available by the Gates Trust and the Meyer Trust to try to personalize high school experiences for students. And I see these programs as having quite parallel intentions.
Chair Morgan, Senator Mesrilli, you're absolutely right. These programs bring all the pieces together for students. They personalize the learning experience. They demonstrate to students the relevance between academic content and practical applications in the real world. They personalize it at many levels, because the programs often allow students to go into the community to complete a work-based learning experience or a supervised ag experience, as is the case with FFA. So they get to experience their education at a very much more meaningful level, and they learn about themselves. They're motivated, they're engaged, and they're quite inspired very often by their dedicated teachers as well.
Further comments? Thank you very much. This was a very informative presentation. And good luck in your trip to Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for accommodating my schedule. Thank you.
We still have more than half an hour left in the presentation, so I will call Bob Siebert forward from the Office of Special Education and the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services, which is, by the way, a mouthful, so I'll refer to the office of CIFS as we go through this, or I'll get hung up. My tongue will make bad changes to those words if I keep repeating it over and over again. I have several pieces of information for you to look at, including the slides which you have in your notebook, and you'll find immediately behind the slides some further narrative discussion and description of the activities of the Office of Curriculum Instruction. It also is linked to the budget information that we provided you, so that you can see the priorities and the expenditures that we put into those different efforts from the department or from our office. And be able to describe further, and I'll actually hit the highlights now as I go through this presentation. And as my nerves wear off a little bit, my voice will stop shaking.
Well, we are pretty scary.
Yes, you are. No, it's not so much you as it is just the situation that I find myself in. I also have passed out to you a standards newspaper that we provide to teachers statewide annually. The standards newsletter is one of our major communication links to teachers and administrators in the school concerning standards for all of our content areas, the status of the standards, the relevance to instruction in the classrooms through all the grades in schools. And I think we'll answer some of the questions that you may have had when Bill Addy was making his presentation about what those standards are and how they're derived and what they mean to teachers. The first slide, are we ready there? We're almost there. You'll see on this slide here that
moving right
we do very little.
It confirms everything you said.
That's right. Spend very little money. The first slide, actually, you'll recognize from previous.
Senator Gordley has a question. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm wondering if this document also goes to parents.
It is available to parents. In fact, every year we publish enough for every teacher and every administrator in the state. We send it out to every school and make it available to teachers. And we have many, many, many requests from teachers. Usually we run out of our publication because of that. The parents want to know as much as their teachers do about what the standards are and what our expectations are for student performance. It's well distributed and widely distributed to parents as well as educational staff.
So, but is there an organized, systematic effort to get this kind of information into the hands of every parent? Does your office coordinate that activity, or how do we know it's going on?
Generally speaking, we don't make contacts with every parent in the state. Oh, there I am. To let them know that this is available. We do ask schools to share the information with parents. We have it available on our website where parents may visit and, in fact, obtain the information or order copies from us. But in terms of notifying every parent, we don't necessarily do that.
I'm just trying to get a sense, Madam Chair, of parent awareness and how we measure that, or if we measure that. In any
I don't believe we measure that at this point.
Okay. Sue, perhaps when we get into the work session on this budget and we're looking at the performance measures, we could raise this issue again.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make a note of it, then.
Thank you.
Oh, we do keep in the Office of Curriculum Instruction, we do keep sort of informal information about how many parents are ordering the newsletter, how many are coming to our website around content standards and curriculum. But we certainly could, in fact, do a more formalized measure, and maybe a very good idea to do that.
I think we need to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
This is the first slide that you've seen common across all of the presentations. It does lay out the Office of Curriculum Instruction Appeal Services budget with a general fund amount of $5.1 million. Generally, the general fund amount, that $5.1 million, is used to support academic standards development, implementation, dissemination work. We also support school and district accountability work that our office does, and support the schools, other kinds of support to schools that we provide through our regional services team out of the Office of Curriculum Instruction. Other funds at $216,000 is used to support instructional materials review and evaluation, and information to schools about the quality of the instructional materials available by content area, and so that they have the best possible opportunity to know which instructional materials from publishers are available that match to our standards for curriculum instruction. We also have $6.2 million in operations funds from federal sources that help support the administration and field services for highly qualified teachers grant, Title IIA out of the No Child Left Behind, educational technology grant, Title IID out of the No Child Left Behind, Reading First grant, which is a very major grant that the state received for beginning this school year, known as Title IB out of the No Child Left Behind program or grant or a law, and charter schools. And we have a considerable amount of grant and aid funds that we provide to charter schools in the state through our office. The purpose of our office is really to assist teachers, schools, and other educational staff to create standards in curriculum, to develop and provide high-quality resources and model curriculum to schools, and to all of that with the purpose of working at reducing the achievement gap for children that are low performing, that in fact higher quality instruction and higher quality teachers can make the difference. We do that, by the way, through working with schools and school staff on standards, content standards, and working with the Office of Assessment around assessments of children, so we can really measure how well these efforts are making a difference for kids in schools. CIF stakeholders, we work on a statewide basis with just about everybody in the state. We work with 198 school districts every year in communicating standards, content standards, and curriculum for their use in schools. We work with about 24 charter schools this year in ensuring that charter schools are compliant with Oregon law, but also are providing the best opportunity for children, and ensuring that schools and charter schools public schools and charter schools work in tandem and as partners rather than becoming difficult, that relationship becoming difficult, so that charter schools have the best opportunity to thrive in the state of Oregon under Oregon law. 72 public alternative schools, about 21,000 children we work with on an annual basis. 80 private alternative schools, about 3,500 children every year. 327 private schools that are registered through our office that we work with through registrations, ensuring that they meet state standards under our registration. And about 14,500 homeschooling children. So we have a rather broad reach and a broad effect across the state.
Madam
we also work with a lot of partners. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would just point out here again, I understand that homeschool parents are included as stakeholders, but it's the rest of the parents that
yes,
we would
absolutely.
Also be concerned about and want to see them included.
That's right.
Thank you.
I'm in absolute agreement with that. We do a number of direct projects. The most important amongst these is providing a statewide framework for instruction in classrooms. We do this through developing curriculum and implementing our standards through three levels. One is through common curriculum goals, which sets out the expectations for achievement across the student's career in the public education system. Content standards that describes those expectations in more detail by a grade level, and then by grade level expectations through K-2 and through the rest of the public school system, which provides more detail to the teachers in the classroom where they can align their lesson plans, their daily work with kids to ensure that it's aligned with the content standards. So it's a level of detail that we go from a fairly umbrella approach through the common curriculum goals, through content standards, and then detailed expectations for students' performances across the K-12 system. We do this, by the way, through a rather extensive citizen involvement process as we develop these standards, both at the common curriculum goals level and the content standards level. We bring teams of teachers together that work with us to ensure that we're developing a schematic or a scheme of curriculum through K-12 that represents what teachers in Oregon are teaching, that are aligned so that across districts we can have the same level of expectations in each grade level for each kid. And that it is work that would support what teachers are doing in the classroom. We always have to make sure that what we're providing is something that makes sense to teachers and that they can use on a regular basis, on a daily basis in their classrooms. The next slide is just basically a schematic about how we approach this process. We have an umbrella of the common curriculum goals. We develop those into content standards in each content area required under statute and also that are taught by schools. And those are developed into curriculum frameworks at a level of detail that teachers can use at each grade level. We provide those standards through the contents that you see in the next slide. I'm not going to read them, but you'll notice that we cover a very broad spectrum of instruction in schools, from reading through writing, mathematics, etc., so that every content area teachers have a framework of instruction through the curriculum, content standards, and frameworks so that they can link carefully to the assessments that the state provides. You have in front of you the newspaper, which is one of our major communications links to teachers and administrators in schools so they can see and understand the curriculum content standards that the state has developed and how that applies to them individually as teachers and as administrators in schools. We also have a website that provides all the same information so that it can be accessed online by teachers and administrators in schools. We're planning a website that would also provide a database so that teachers can manipulate those goals, content standards, and instructional frameworks to match with what they're doing in the classrooms on a daily basis. We also provide teaching and learning to standards published every year that provides additional information to teachers about our curriculum frameworks. All of this is done so that we have good, clear connections with schools and with teachers so that they know and understand and can use the information that we're providing through the content standards and the curriculum frameworks that we provide. The next slide talks a little bit about our links to the quality education model. Clearly, there are characteristics of schools that the quality education model purports. We have taken that model and developed characteristics of schools, what those schools look like, if in fact they implemented and demonstrated those characteristics. We use that with schools on a regular basis. Upon request right now, we visit those schools for review. We evaluate where they are against those characteristics of the quality education model, provide them feedback so that they can better plan and better implement programs that meet standards of the QEM.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
So this allows for a school to... They may request a diagnostic review, but what if they don't?
At this point, we have the resources to just about meet the request that we have from schools to come in and do an evaluation. It takes a bit of resource. It does take staff, and it does take time to do that evaluation. It takes a look at their curriculum. It takes a look at their instruction. It takes a look at their staffing. It takes a look at all the activities that the school embodies and evaluates that against the QEM. It's a very useful, very worthwhile activity. It gives them a lot of feedback about how they're doing and where they can improve. We would like to increase that capacity and have plans for the future to do that. I think it's a very effective model that we have. This is the first year that we've really implemented it, and we obviously had some reduced resources, so we're unable to do as many as we'd like.
So there is no track record about how successful this is in schools being able to raise their assessments or their grades?
Yeah, actually, we have a track record just over the last year and a half. Districts where we have done some visits, we've worked out with 19 over the last 2 years, 10 this year. 10 of those schools that we visited, all have improved their status on the Oregon Report Card. That's the measure we have right now to be able to evaluate that that project or that component that we have in our program. Now, the problem is that there's been several schools that have raised their scores in, on the report card, and so to know in a research basis that this particular model works better than other things that we're doing, we don't have that data. We don't have enough track record to know. We would certainly like to know.
So you don't have a way to know if it's this particular program that's contributing to the raising of the grades?
Mm-hmm. 10 schools is not enough experience in 1 year.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Again, just to clarify, the diagnostic review for low-performing schools isn't a requirement.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I didn't mean to lead you astray. What we do for low-performing schools actually is some other things that we have as projects in our office. This is one of those that's fairly new in our system, and so it isn't necessarily the only thing we do, nor perhaps where we have our most effort going into low-performing schools.
So it's a tool in the toolbox?
Yeah, it's a tool in the toolbox, that's right.
Okay.
And we have several tools, all of which we need to start implementing and doing a more concerted effort, knowing as well as you do that low-performing schools under No Child Left Behind will, the number will increase over the next couple of months.
Thank you.
The Department of Education also, and Office of Curriculum Instruction, also works with accountability from other avenues. We look at the standards under Division 2021 and 22 to ensure that schools are meeting the state standards under statute and under state board rule for the qualities of an education program in an elementary and secondary school. This is just another look at how to ensure that the children in Oregon's public schools have a base environment that promotes learning. The school standards in Division 22 really is a way to establish what a school should include, the base programs and services it needs to have in order to provide a good quality educational setting so that children have an opportunity to learn. Quality education model also provides another set of characteristics. So we bring those two sets together. One is the quality education characteristics, about 12 of them in our evaluation form, and then the standards process through Division 22 standards reviews. We do these on an annual basis over time. Again, this year we've had a less opportunity to do standards reviews with schools due to budgetary reasons. And we do need to reinstitute and reimplement that process because it really does guarantee a safe, clean, healthy environment for children with certain programs and services available to them and to teachers in the classrooms so that they can get on with the job of teaching the content that they are required to teach. We also have about $85 million in federal grant programs in our office, in the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. They include Reading First, highly qualified teachers from No Child Left Behind, educational technology, and charter schools. And those grants are, by and large, formula grants, all but the Reading First grant actually is. They're all formula grants. We calculate the amounts that each district and school receives and pass those dollars through to those schools. Reading First grant is a little bit different. It is competitive in nature, although there is a formula that determines which schools would be eligible under the program. But then a competitive process is run so that schools could become eligible for receiving grants under Reading First project. Charter schools is also a competitive grant process. Again, it's structured by the federal law to be targeted to certain characteristics of charter schools to help promote charter schools. Become chartered by their local boards, and these are run as a competitive grant in through our office.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. What is the system for monitoring to ensure that each school district is using the funds in the categories described? I'm particularly interested in the teacher quality. Oh, I'm interested in all of them.
Highly qualified teachers. Well, let's, Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, let's deal with highly qualified teachers. We have about 19 minutes left, and I think that's one that I would like to talk about right away. The highly qualified teachers law under No Child Left Behind requires the Department of Education to take federal funds that are available to us and pass them through to school districts. They can use those funds in multiple for multiple purposes in their school. All of them, however, are promoting and enhancing the quality of the teachers through staff development activities, through other activities that the school wants to conduct to improve the teacher quality. The state law, however, requires that the state develop a definition and a set of characteristics for what a highly qualified teacher is in our state. We have been doing a considerable work over the last 12 months developing that definition and detailing that definition so that we can implement or practicalize what a highly qualified teacher means in the state of Oregon. I have Vicki Chamberlain from Teacher Standards and Practices Commission today here. We just worked until about 5:30 last night sort of finalizing some decisions on the highly qualified teacher definition. She'd be willing to come and discuss that particular component of this law if you wish.
Madam Chair, the thrust of my question was, how do we know that districts are spending the grant funds, the federal grant funds, for these four categories? What is the system for monitoring the districts to ensure that the dollars are being spent right for the correct purpose?
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, there's actually, we use two approaches to this. One is a sort of a front-end approach, which is for the districts to apply for the funds and describe what they would use those funds for. For the formula grants, they need to tell us for what purposes they would use the dollars. Then we and budget to the dollars that would be available through the formula to them. For the competitive grants, we actually solicit through an RFP grants from the eligible agencies, potential charter schools and others, to tell us how they would use the dollars to, for instance, develop and implement a new charter school in a particular district. Periodically, after the grant is given, we ask for accounting, how are the dollars being used and for what purposes. And at the end of the project, once the project is over, we ask for a final accounting and a report that tells us exactly what was done with the money that was granted to them. And we try to make this as absolutely streamlined and as least imposing as possible, but we do have accounting responsibilities under federal and state laws, and we make sure that we do meet those requirements.
So do we have access to an accounting today for how the districts are using the federal grant funds in these four categories?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I can say yes to that except for the work term today. I would like to put the information together and be able to get it to you later. I don't have it available.
And then the follow-up, Madam Chair, would be, are you comfortable that the grant funds are being used in the manner in which has been defined?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I'm comfortable. I know many of the school districts, the staff in those school districts. This is my 26th year at the department, so I have a lot of people that I know around the state. I ask them on a regular basis, so I'm very comfortable with the answers that I'm getting from the school district staff that are using these dollars. I believe we have all the accountability systems in place that will guarantee the dollars are used appropriately and according to the federal requirements.
Thank you.
I will keep going. next slide. The next several slides actually will recount the amounts of money that we spend for basically six functions in the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. Implementation of academic standards for a total of $2.4 million. That, by the way, is about 43% of the dollars, general fund dollars that we have available. We spend on the development, implementation, and support to schools on content standards, integrating those content standards into the curriculum on a daily basis at the teacher level. It's very critical that we make that connection. We can't just send them out in a newsletter, as you see, or a newspaper. We actually have to work with those teachers, work with those school administrators, and helping them align what they are teaching in classes so that the content standards are addressed at the appropriate grade levels at the right time for kids. The back end of this, and the reason we want to do this on the front end is the back end is that there are state assessments. And if we have a misalignment between the content standards and what's being taught in classrooms across the state and what's being assessed on the assessments, we won't have the results that we and you have asked for from the Department of Education from schools around the state. So it's critical that we ensure that that alignment is done, and it's done at the teacher level so that they understand what they're working with in the classroom in terms of instruction and the content. We also, the improvement in teacher quality, we spend approximately $190,000 of general funds. These are four processes and projects and activities that enhance professional development in schools. But as you can see, by and large, the general amounts of funds that are spent for improving teacher quality comes part of, from our federal grant out of the 2A No Child Left Behind grant program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Massa.
That's a considerable amount of money. What kind of programs does that fund?
Madam Chair and Senator Messley, the, generally the programs are structured under the federal law, under No Child Left Behind, under Title IIA. At the school level, the schools have a choice of several different focuses or emphases that they would like to choose for their schools, and the state, in fact, when we receive the applications, as long as they're within those focus foci, then would permit or make the grant to the school district. They cover all kinds of areas of professional, but it's basically professional development. It's enhancing the capabilities of teachers and ensuring that they meet the standard for highly qualified teachers in Oregon. At the state level, we keep a certain amount, a very small amount, for administration of the project or the administration of the federal grant. It's a very small amount. That's why we have to enhance the amount by about $190,000 to make sure that we continue doing that job. The remainder of the money is actually split up into two parts. One part is a requirement under No Child Left Behind that we pass through approximately 1.4, 1.5 million for the next biennium to higher education. The higher education institutions then have a set of projects that the federal law outlines they may use to enhance professional development, teacher quality through their offices. The remainder of the funds are about $900,000 to $1 million a year is left at the Department of Education for us to then carry out statewide staff development activities, promoting personal development in schools, doing other activities that will enhance teacher quality in the state. This year is the first year that we received these funds. Due to the cuts that we took through the five special sessions, we have placed this money behind many of our content specialists who do teacher quality work, but has been a way of backfilling for the general funds.
Madam Chair.
Senator follow-up.
I would like to see some kind of documentation as to what kind of programs we're funding with these federal funds. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Gordon.
Thank you. And in addition to that, what are the performance measures for this category?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, under No Child Left Behind, the performance measure is that all teachers in the state of Oregon meet the standards for being a highly qualified teacher in the state of Oregon. Under our standards, under teachers and standards and practices, policies and procedures, and that's really where we're driving with the law. We want to ensure that there's a very high level of capacity and capability in the teachers that teach children in Oregon. We will measure that against data that we'll collect starting this spring about what teachers currently meet the definition of which teachers do not. Over the next 4 years, we'll be using these funds to work with schools, work with higher education, work with our partners to ensure that all teachers do meet that standard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do the partners include the private institutions as well as the public?
Hang on just a second.
Marty? I think...
Oh, jeez.
No, is she all right?
Are you all right?
Oh, my ankle fell asleep. I apologize. For the record, I'm Mardale Dunsworth with the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services.
And luckily continues to be with the office.
Excuse me, what was the question again?
Take a deep breath.
And we're not trying to distract you.
I think we all want to take a deep breath with
I'm fine.
You're okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're okay. The question is, are we coordinating our efforts around improving teacher quality with the private higher ed institutions as well as the public higher ed institutions?
Yes, all of the higher ed institutions participate in Title IIA funding. They all do participate through the OSHE grant.
Including
and OSHE is?
The Office of Higher Education.
The OSHE grant is the about $1.4 million in federal funds out of 2A that we pass through to higher education institutions. They, generally speaking, will bring together both public institutions and the private institutions in a planning process and for use of the dollars to promote staff development in the schools and in pre-service education.
I'll follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Seward, it would be helpful, because I haven't found information in the notebooks, mm-hmm. Unless I'm overlooking it. It would be helpful to see some more detailed information that describes and defines how we will measure improving teacher quality. What's the benchmark? And included in that information, some more detailed information about our partners in this effort. You mentioned the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. You've clarified that the independent institutions also have a role in this. Mm-hmm. But my question goes to how will we get there? Who's helping us do that? Mm-hmm. And how will we know that we've achieved the goal?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, I'd be glad to bring that information. What I want to preface or post comment that No Child Left Behind is a recent, not new, but recent, and so we have developed a plan that we have provided to the feds, federal government, in our annual application last year that proposes a set of activities over the course of the year this year to plan and develop how we will do that promotion of professional development for teachers. We're working through the steps of getting that plan into place. We're going to provide another application to the federal government soon. And implement the law as we go. So we won't have the complete layout for you, but I'll provide you what we can.
Okay. Madam Chair, a greater understanding of how we're moving forward here will help us understand what results we should look for in student achievement, mm-hmm. direct connection, and just need to make sure that we understand the link.
Right.
The linkage.
Perhaps if Vicki could come up, she could add to the discussion. Vicki, do you want to come up and take a... I also have concerns in this area, Senator Gordley, because there seems to be a presumption that if teachers go through training programs that they automatically become highly qualified teachers. And it's interesting to me that we have a process in place to chart the progress that individual students make through the educational system as they progress from grade to grade and level to level and competency to competency. But for some reason, there's a reticence to attach teachers to that so that there can be some way to evaluate which teachers are being competently trained and which ones aren't, which ones are able to untangle that place where kids are getting hung up and help them move along, and which ones aren't getting that part of it in terms of becoming highly qualified teachers. And so I'm really curious about why there is just a kind of a mindset to say that if I have this diploma or this credential or I've taken this class and passed it, that I'm automatically a highly qualified teacher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices.
OK.
Commission. I heard about five questions in there. let me start with the teacher accountability inside the programs in Oregon and then move on to the notion of I'm highly qualified because I have a diploma. The Federal Higher Education Act, Title II, requires us to report to the federal government annually about how our teacher candidates are performing in all our schools, privates and publics. And there are 18 universities that prepare teachers. Oregon adopted a definition that said that you can't be considered a program completer in a higher ed institution until you have passed all the tests. You've completed all your class requirements, and you've passed the basic skills test and your content area test to get a license. So teacher candidates who aren't passing the test cannot get a license to teach other than a substitute license in Oregon until they pass the test, which has kept us in good alignment, at least with No Child Left Behind, wanting to measure teacher competency. You asked a question that I think is really difficult to answer, and that is one that No Child Left Behind does not help us with, because the federal law now says that if I have my diploma and I pass the test and I prove to you that I know my math, let's say, inside out, I'm a highly qualified teacher, that does not mean I can go into the class necessarily and lead my students to learning gains. And I think that is what we here in Oregon were trying to accomplish with our final stage license, the continuing teaching license, that now after you've been teaching for 3 years, you have to go through a peer review and a higher ed review to show that you can lead students to learning gains to get our final stage license. So I'm not sure I answered all of your points, but I think that I feel pretty clear that we have a pretty good accounting system for Oregon candidates. And let me talk about out-of-state just real briefly. Out-of-state candidates who haven't passed the test or haven't completed a teacher education program do not get a full license in Oregon until they meet our standards that are equivalent to our Oregon graduates. So that is our way that we maintain quality. We've licensed over 9,000 out-of-state teachers in the last 3 years, and only 1,400 of them have not met the state requirement so far. And that includes, like, the people we've licensed up to last week in terms of giving them a new license. So they're out-of-staters are moving very quickly to full licensure here. Hmm.
Can she come back tomorrow, I'm wondering?
Up against the time wall here, would it be convenient for you to return for tomorrow's session? Because I think that this is an area that we have a great deal of interest in exploring. So seeing people kind of close up binders and pack things away here, what I'll do is close the public hearings on House Bill 5014 and 1515 and adjourn the subcommittee meeting, and we'll reconvene.
Well, you know how to do an entrance, don't you?